So I think all those words are going to probably need some explanation. So let's start with thick sandwich problem. The basic idea is if you have some space-like hypersurface with some fixed geometry and some final space-like hypersurface, again, with some fixed intrinsic geometry, you want to know what the Feynman propagator is from the initial surface to the final surface. Or, you know, colloquially, what we're trying to ask is what's the probability of this initial geometry transitioning to this final geometry? And what are the space times which dominate the path integral that would allow you to calculate this, i.e. what is the appropriate saddle point approximation? So CDT is going to be a path integral formulation of quantum mechanics that regularizes that path integral developed by Renata Wohl and Jan Amjorn. And the idea of a path integral, of course, is that you have some initial particle, at some initial position and some final position. Classically, it takes the straightest possible path between the two that extremizes your action. And quantum mechanically, it takes all possible paths, and the probability of it transitioning, or the Feynman propagator, more formally, is given by the path integral over all of those paths of the e to the is phase factor, where s is the action. So usually we do this kind of calculation perturbatively, i.e. with path diagrams or whatever you like. But in the strong coupling regime, you can't really do this. So one approach, which is the approach of CDT, is to regularize your path integral by taking your continuum and discretizing it and putting it on a lattice and then doing quantum field theory on a lattice. And I'll explain the details of the exact choice of lattice regularization that CDT makes in a bit. But once you do this, you've imposed a UV cutoff, and your path integral is now regular. So once you've performed this UV cutoff, your path integral has become a path sum over Boltzmann over the e to the is factors with an unknown or possibly unknown measure mu. But you may still not be able to handle this because it may be combinatorically too difficult. So one approach to handling that is to analytically continue time in the complex plane, which will map a Lorentzian signature to a Euclidean one, and it'll transform your path integral into a partition function, where you now have a sum over e to the minus s, where s is the Euclidean action after you've done your analytic continuation. And now you can use standard statistical mechanics. And so, for example, you have these Boltzmann factors, and you can think of them as essentially the probability of being in the state given by the geometry G. And you can sample from this partition function by taking some arbitrary spacetime and measuring this Boltzmann factor, make a small change to your spacetime, measure it again, and then you might, if you want to find the most probable spacetime, you accept that change if it's more probable, and reject it with some probability if it's less probable. You repeat this enough times, and you're exploring all possible states of configurations of your space-time. And eventually, once you've done this enough times, you've found one that's sort of dominating your path integral, or is sort of a probable state in your classical statistical distribution. So, Florian.
So this procedure is going to converge even if the action is not bounded?
Let me think about that. No, if your action is bounded, I mean, if this Boltzmann factor is for some reason not bounded, then you're out of luck. But assuming that your Boltzmann factor is bounded, then it works. So it doesn't depend on. I mean, you can translate that to a statement about the action, but it depends on the Boltzmann factor, not the action. Assuming your Boltzmann factor is bounded, then it may take a very large number of attempts in this procedure, but in principle, it should always converge. Assuming certain conditions about how you make these changes, technical details of this procedure. Please ask me questions as we go. You don't have to wait till the end. Florian is doing it correctly. Once you do this once, you have a single probable spacetime. And this is essentially like, you can sort of imagine that you're an experimentalist and you've done a measurement and you've made a measurement of your quantum system. To measure observables, you need to make a bunch of measurements. So you generate an ensemble of these things, each of which sort of represents a single measurement of your system. So sort of to summarize where we've gone so far, we've taken a path integral formulation and translated it into a sum over histories formulation in the quantum field theoretic sense, where the probability of some initial space-like geometry transitioning into some final space-like geometry, or more formally, the transition amplitudes, is given by the sum over all possible spacetimes which interplay between the two. What I haven't told you so far is how this regularization procedure works. And what we use is in CDT is Regi calculus. And I'm not going to go into too many details, but the essential idea here is that you take your smooth manifold and you approximate it by a piecewise flat one, or in Lorentzian signature, a piecewise Minkowski one. And then the curvature is encoded in the codimension 2 submanifolds of this manifold. So in two dimensions, for example, the curvature is encoded at these vertices. In 4 dimensions, it's encoded in faces. And in 3 dimensions, it's encoded, it's 3 spacetime dimensions, it's encoded in edges. A very important ingredient in CDT, due to Renata Lowell and Jan Amjorn, is that the Wick rotation that I described, this analytic continuation, is only well-defined if time has a well-defined direction. And so Amjorn and Lowell impose specific conditions to make sure this is always possible. The first is that they demand their spacetime admit a foliation of space-like hypersurfaces, which is not as crazy as it sounds, because this is essentially the condition you need to have a well-posed initial value problem in classical general relativity. It's essentially global hyperbolicity. And they also demand that the topology of a leaf of the foliation cannot change in time. This is classically forbidden in GR anyway, but it's conceivable that classically forbidden states are allowed in a quantum theory, but in CDT, it's just forbidden. Oh, sorry, that's causal dynamical triangulations. Okay. So from now on, I'm going to be describing 2 plus 1 causal dynamical triangulations, or 2 plus 1 dimensional as opposed to 3 plus 1 dimensional. And in 2 plus 1 dimensional CDT, there are 3 pieces of Minkowski space, these tetrahedra, which you build your spacetime out of, and they're suspended between adjacent leaves of your foliation. And so that sort of looks like this. This would be an example triangulation. All of these tetrahedra are equilateral. That's not the only choice you could make, but it's one of many equivalent choices. And this picture here, they don't look equilateral, but that's just because I couldn't fit a triangulation of a curved manifold that's 3-dimensional into a 2-dimensional plane. So they don't look curved anymore after projection. Okay, so the procedure for generating an ensemble, as I described, sort of the technical details, is you fix the topology of the space-like hypersurfaces you're interested in. You fix the number of leaves in your foliation and the space-time volume, so the number of tetrahedra or simplex that you want total. And then you fix the initial and final space-like geometries. Once you've done that, you can sample from your partition function, generating a large ensemble of measurements. And then you can look at observables. So I want to emphasize that in these kinds of statistical approaches where you're doing Monte Carlo simulations and you're sampling from a partition function, you've lost something. You've completely lost access to your original path integral. You can no longer access that. What you have access to is the quantum mechanical observables that you would have in this theory. Okay, so I'll give you an example of sort of how,
for Anne. What is fixing the space-time volume?
Okay, yeah. So this is a technical constraint of having to be on a computer, which is that you can only handle a finite number of triangulations. But as far as the theory goes, once you've made this choice, what it means is that implicit in this whole construction is, so the action that I'm using is the Einstein-Hilbert action with the cosmological constant. And if you want there to be a fixed number of space-time variables, essentially you've added a Lagrange multiplier to that action. And to admit that, your cosmological constant and your Newton constant run with respect to each other. So as you change the number of, as you change your space-time volume, you essentially are renormalizing your Newton's constant and your cosmological constant. Bustative.
So why is it that you don't think that this is a path integral for a unimodular graph?
Yeah, well, so as I'll describe, it's not totally clear what the low energy limit of this theory is.
Right, sure.
So it's true that we are imposing the Einstein-Hilbert action, but it's not clear that what we're recovering is GR. Raphael, you've...
when you have those spacetimes, which are realizations of your Monte Carlo simulation, do you then do a classical probabilistic mean? Or?
Yes, it's classical. Did you have a question, Raphael?
Just correct me now, although I've heard talks on this many times. You said you fix both the number of simplexes, which is like fixing the spacetime volume. Then you say you also fix the number of slices.
Yeah.
So isn't that that's something like fixing the average area or spatial value. So what's the effect of that constraint?
Right. It's subtle, I think. So in many situations, as I'll show, it doesn't seem to matter. You can, if you choose too many leaves of your foliation, the space-time sort of, the theory sort of chooses dynamically what it wants its characteristic length scale to be. But in the case, in some cases, and I won't go into too much detail here, it does seem to matter, and it may give you unphysical results. Okay, so I'll give you an example of how this works. So this is a simulation that I ran that's going to turn out to mimic some of the earliest triumphs by Renata and Amya and Jan. And the idea is that I've generated a huge ensemble, and I've measured the space-like volume of each space-like hypersurface in my foliation. This by itself is not a meaningful observable, but if you measure it as a function of time, it becomes one. And so what I'm plotting here is the ensemble average of essentially the space-like volume of each space-like hypersurface in spherical topology as a function of time, discrete Euclidean time. And so once I have this, what I have to do is I essentially have to do effective field theory. I've done an experiment, and I have to match it to a continuum theory. So I'm going to make a very simplistic guess, and I'm going to say that my metric depends only on the space-time volume, in other words, or space-like volume. In other words, I'm making sort of a standard cosmological assumption. This corresponds to a mini-superspace effective action in Euclidean signature, which is extremized by a scale factor that goes as a cosine. And you may recognize that as the circumference of a line of latitude as a function of longitude on the surface of a sphere. And a sphere is the Wick-rotated version of de Sitter space. So what I've just discovered is that, since all of this was done in Euclidean signature, what I've discovered is that my theory post-Wick rotation looks like if I had just done GR and Wick rotated it. So this, at least in the very most simple vacuum positive cosmological constant case. This was an early triumph because it says that the theory at least sort of looks like it recovers classical theory once you take the appropriate limit. The appropriate limit here being that I've used many, many simplices, so I've sort of taken a long wavelength limit, and it's the saddle point approximation because I'm only looking at essentially the one-point function. Okay, so I'm now going to get into this, basically my work. The standard way of doing the thick sandwich problem in CDT has typically done calculations where time is periodic. Essentially, what you're doing if you make this choice is that you're taking some space-like hypersurface of fixed geometry, arbitrary fixed geometry, and asking the transition amplitude for it to itself. My contribution to this field has been that I've introduced the ability to actually impose initial and final space-like hypersurfaces of arbitrary fixed geometry. And what I'm going to talk about here is where you impose them such that that geometry is essentially homogeneous. So I take the initial and final hypersurfaces to be spheres of fixed volume, which I control. What?
The same volume both?
No, I can vary the, yeah. Okay, so just very briefly, I want to discuss the semi-classical expectation that you might have for this. Basically, what I'm saying is I want to look at cosmology, the only thing in the simplest possible sense, where the only thing that matters is the scale factor. And semi-classically, in vacuum with positive cosmological constant, you might expect this always to look like pieces of De Sitter space. And so, in the case of a Wick rotation, that's pieces of a sphere. So if you take the initial and final geometries to be as small as possible, in other words, the initial and this is sort of a no-boundary proposal, but not really, because there's a finite minimum size. You might expect to recover the entire De Sitter space or the entire sphere. But if you fix the initial to be some minimal piece and the final to be something non-minimal, you might expect a piece of the sphere where you either have the end cap or the sphere without the end cap. Well, and if you choose them both to be non-minimal, you might expect the sphere without these end caps. So I already talked about case one. That was sort of the simplest possible example. So I'm just going to talk about case two now. What I'm showing on the top here is I've taken the initial geometry to be minimal. And the final geometry, I've varied the volume of the sphere. And so what you're looking at is all of these possible interpolating ensemble average scale factors. And as you can see, they all sort of look like pieces of a cosine. And you'll notice here, and this is getting into what Raphael was talking about, that at this side, you get a stock of sort of minimal volume. And I've chosen one of these spacetimes, and I'm plotting it down here. This is the same plot as here. And you see that you have this stock. And this has showed up in most calculations in CDT, and it is essentially, well, people didn't really know what it is, but I argued it's a numerical artifact that exactly incorporates for the fact that you have fixed number of leaves in your foliation. And the evidence for this is that if I reduce the number of leaves in my foliation but keep everything else fixed, the stock vanishes, but the bulk of the space-time remains. And so basically what this is telling us is that this stock is an artifact of the fact that the space-time is choosing dynamically the length scale or the time scale that it wants to have. However, so this all matches the semi-classical expectations. However, in the case of initial and final non-minimal boundary data, it turns out not to match our semi-classical expectations at all. It's possible to construct space-times where the interpolating, scale factor as a function of time looks not like cosine, but hyperbolic cosine. And this essentially means that, well, hyperbolic cosine is the Wick rotation of anti-De Sitter space, negative cosmological constant. Or alternatively, it's as if we've changed our cosmological constant or changed our signature of our metric. And so we were confused by this for a very long time, since it seemed to imply that there might be an effective signature change that is possible in CDT. It turns out that in this paper, I argue, along with my collaborators, that this is, in fact, coming from exactly the system being too overconstrained, as Raphael was asking about. So if you're interested in that story, check out this paper. I don't really have time to go into the details at the moment.
Talk about teasing.
So, to summarize, CDT is a sum over history approach to quantum gravity, which regularizes the path integral. Early evidence suggests it has a good classical limit, and although I didn't talk about it, there's also some interesting quantum behavior that happens if you take sort of an opposite approach and look at short length scales. And I hope I've convinced you that there's some interesting ground to cover when studying the thick sandwich problem in particular, where you vary the initial and final geometries. So at that, I'll take more questions if you have them, and put up a bunch of my own questions, which I think are interesting, that I hope to solve.
We have less than a minute for any other question.
Yep.
If it's a fixed sandwich problem for two different geometries in the initial and the final,
yeah,
I would expect your expectation values to be Greek values, which would have the real part and then the imaginary part. Is there any way you can treat that in your calculation? Because you seem to treat the probability calculation like classical probability, how formally you would expect it.
I don't know anything about weak values, but we should talk. Maybe it's possible to extract that by being more careful.
Maybe
I'm
meaning that.
Yes, please.
Okay.
Could you not make the number of leaves in the foliation also be a variable? In other words, doing some extended Monte Carlo. I don't know exactly which moves would take you from one number of leaves to another.
Yeah, that's.
But there should be some.
I agree, that should be possible. I think that'd be really interesting to explore.